As if we needed it, a reminder yet again today that the global economy is a complicated mix of politics, trade policy, and supply chain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 6th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. One hesitates to draw clear, bright lines when discussing something as complicated as global trade, but it's entirely possible the short-term future, at least, of the Sino-American economic relationship hinges on what is tentatively scheduled to happen in a Canadian courtroom tomorrow. Meng Wanzhou, the CFO of Huawei, China's largest privately owned company, the daughter of its founder to boot, is going to have a bail hearing. She was arrested in Vancouver yesterday, as you have surely heard, at the request of the United States, which is seeking her extradition to face charges of violating the American embargo against Iran, including apparently other charges as well. Those are the legal stipulations. The economic reality goes like this. Huawei is a global giant. It's the world's biggest telecommunications equipment maker. It's a key player in the global electronics supply chain. But at the same time, it's not really so well known here. So we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson and Scott Tong to get together and tell us everything we need to know about Huawei and why it matters.
In the course of reporting the story, Scott and I kept hearing one phrase over and over to describe Huawei.
National champions.
A national champion.
They're really the national champion, if you will, of national champions in China.
In other words, Huawei is one of the corporate crown jewels of China. China wants to be a big player in the high-tech fields of tomorrow, and it's investing big to help develop these companies.
And Huawei is already a global titan. It sells laptops and more smartphones than Apple. It's the biggest player in equipment for the internet backbone and wireless networks. It's also helping build the next generation of 5G wireless networks.
In China, Huawei is known for having top talent. That's according to Ann Stevenson Yang, research director at J Capital Research.
The Chinese people view Huawei as, you know, a cut above in technology. It's prestigious to work for Huawei. If you work for Huawei, it's thought that, you know, you must be really smart.
But the view from the U.S. is quite different. Ishwar Prasad is a trade policy professor at Cornell.
The perception in the U.S. is probably that Huawei is just another big bad Chinese corporation that is trying to take over the world and, what's more, also poses a security risk.
A risk that Huawei's technology gives the Chinese government a back door to let it see sensitive information or communications.
Huawei has always denied this. It says it's a privately owned firm, not state-owned, and it's not clear what evidence the intelligence community actually has, according to Paul Triolo. He's a global tech analyst at the Eurasia Group.
There are a lot of anecdotal stories that have showed up in the media, but there is no real clear evidence that says, you know, the Chinese government ordered Huawei to do a particular thing, right? But in general, tech companies do oftentimes do the bidding of their government.
Right now, there are efforts in D.C. to keep equipment made by Huawei and other Chinese companies out of the 5G networks of the future. You know, autonomous vehicles, smart toasters, and all kinds of machines talking to one another.
And this exclusion may be going global. Last month, New Zealand blocked a mobile provider from using Huawei technology. The company faces similar restrictions in Australia and the United Kingdom. So we could be moving toward what some call a splinter net, a telecom world in China and other countries using Huawei equipment, and a separate network without it.
Things are already moving in that direction, says economist Mary Lovely at Syracuse.
Already we have this bifurcated world that has the potential to spread to all business services. This growing splinterization is very much in the minds of tech company executives.
They're worried that a network in much of the world without Huawei hurts the company and its suppliers. There are more than 30 of those in the U.S., making billions of dollars off the Chinese company. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Stocks have been in the news a lot the past month, maybe a little bit longer, but what there hasn't been a lot of is news about companies trying to get into the capital markets, filing their initial public offerings. This morning, the ride-sharing company Lyft took a step closer to an IPO. It's expected to actually happen sometime early next year, which would put it ahead of Uber, which is also said to be planning to go public sometime in 2019. Two interesting things about that, actually. The sharply different values being placed on the two companies. Uber is worth something like 8 times as much as Lyft. But also, whether being first to the public markets might help Lyft close that gap. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
When Lyft first started in 2012, it set its sights on the U.S. market and watched as Uber set up shop around the world. April Rennie advises companies in the sharing economy.
Trust me, Lyft would like to be global. It's expensive to expand internationally.
Lyft's IPO would raise the cash it needs for that expansion. Rennie says when a ride-sharing company moves abroad,
we start seeing regulatory issues, we start seeing driver protests, we start seeing a lot of things that you need to have financial and human resources to deal with.
Still, Uber's market share in countries like India and Brazil, and its stakes in companies like the Chinese ride-sharing giant Didi, help explain why Uber's valuation is vastly bigger than Lyft's. Evan Raleigh is a professor at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management.
You add up all those numbers, the U.S. business, the stakes in Didi and Grab, the international business, they're going to be worth something between $60 and $75 billion.
That's a conservative estimate. And unlike Uber, Lyft hasn't shown that it can turn a profit. Santosh Rao at Manhattan Venture Partners says if Lyft goes public first, investors might give it the benefit of the doubt.
As long as you show growing bookings, in this case, a growing user base, they will give you a few quarters to show profits.
He says if Lyft becomes the first public ride-hailing company, Uber will be the one watching Lyft to see how things play out. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, first of all, nowhere near as terrible as it could have been. Good, even in some ways. But also, a couple of things to keep your eye on. We'll get the November jobs report tomorrow. That's going to be a biggie. Also, oil just got clobbered today. OPEC is still trying to figure out its production cut, if it's going to have one. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to take you north right now to Oshawa, Ontario, Canada, a country with which, as has been in the news this year, and despite the $2 billion a day of cross-border trade that we do with them, it's a country with which the United States has had all kinds of economic beefs of late. The whole NAFTA thing, the steel and aluminum tariffs still in place, I might add. And not helping at all, the news last week from General Motors that it's going to lay off 15,000 people in North America, closing plants in Maryland, Michigan, Ohio, and Oshawa, Ontario. These are just the latest round of layoffs to hit the Toronto suburb, where GM used to be one of the biggest employers. So, as Marketplace's Emma Jacobs reports, the city has had to learn to diversify its economy.
Canadians have been assembling automobiles in Oshawa for more than a century. Buicks at first, then other GM brands. In the 1930s, the company released a marketing film that touted its plant as a symbol of Canadian industrial might.
What immense machines!
Yes, this is one of Canada's finest stamping plants.
And for generations of Canadians, the Oshawa plant produced lots of steady work.
So at the peak, it would have been 30,000 jobs.
John Henry is chairman of the Regional Government Authority and former mayor of Oshawa. His father and grandfather worked for GM.
Every time there was a strike, the economy of Oshawa would change.
Layoffs and attrition have shrunk the workforce to around 3,000. They produce both cars, including the Cadillac XTS, and trucks, including the Chevy Silverado. The closure could drag down the province of Ontario's GDP by as much as 0.5%. Several companies that supply parts to GM will also close or cut back local operations. One firm, Martin Rea, says it will shutter its plant in neighboring Ajax and will offer to relocate its 77 workers there. Oshawa is not the company town it was in the late 80s, says economist Alan Arkand of the Conference Board of Canada. Back then,
30% of all workers were employed in manufacturing. Today, it's only 8% of workers.
As the GM plant shrank, a large healthcare complex set up shop in town. The University of Ontario Institute of Technology opened its campus here in 2002, and construction and real estate have boomed as people sought affordable places to live near Toronto, about 45 minutes away. Meanwhile, many companies that worked closely with GM adapted during its long decline. Jeff Robinson, president of contractor J.J. McGuire, says GM Oshawa has been the company's mainstay, but
years ago, we strategized to try to diversify from the automotive and find other ways of making money.
Now, GM only accounts for about a quarter of the contractor's employees, and the company has moved into building nursing homes and affordable housing. GM says this round of plant closures will let it shift resources to developing electric and autonomous cars. John Komar argues these changes in the automotive industry could end up being good news for Oshawa in the long run. Komar spent 3 decades at General Motors. Now he runs an automotive research center at University of Ontario's Institute of Technology. The big automakers come here to test their vehicles' new features in a state-of-the-art wind tunnel.
Look above us. These solar lamps are full-spectrum UV. And in fact, we can configure these down so that the vehicle can feel like it's in Arizona on the hot day, or it can feel like a nice sunny day in Alaska.
The university is training students to work for the automakers that remain in Ontario, including GM, which still has a research facility nearby.
In fact, we've had a ramp up of thousands of very, very high-skilled software engineering, electrical engineering, advanced technology work.
Many people in Oshawa hope that GM will build on that trend by retooling the plant to assemble its next generation of vehicles here. In Oshawa, Ontario, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Think back 10 years in this economy, would you? 12 now, really, actually, to what was going on before the financial crisis really hit. The beginning of the housing crash and what that meant, not for the Wall Street banks who'd been bundling up the mortgages and selling them off, but for the people in those houses, millions of whom had to sell or who got foreclosed on. What we're still coming to understand is what the loss of those homes did to people, not just in their pocketbook, but in the way they think about money and how to spend it. Our series about what the financial crisis did to this economy is called How We Changed. Today, Jennifer Drew. She runs a business now selling tiny homes, houses under 1,000 square feet. But 10 years ago, she was in a very different place.
I am 16 years old. My parents ended up losing their home during the financial crisis. Things were just getting, like, abducted from me. It started with our cars, and then finally, it was like our home. We had to move from our community of Missouri City and move back into the inner city of Houston. And I remember just having to tell my neighborhood friends that I could no longer ride my bike to school and I could no longer play with them because we were leaving. I felt completely uprooted from my community at that point. I couldn't understand why because it was nothing that I could do about it. When you lose your home, you never forget that feeling. It travels with you. It's in your decision-making. Having a home, you're able to take more risk. You're able to have a ground zero that other people don't have. So I see the value in home ownership. But I didn't think the traditional path was for me, the 30-year mortgage. That's what kind of got my parents caught up in losing their home. So I wanted a home that I could pay off rather quickly. And I saw tiny houses on Pinterest. I was like, oh, those are nice on wheels. But I didn't really feel like it fit my lifestyle. I actually did an exchange program in Hong Kong where I got my MBA. And I got an opportunity to see how they value community, even with smaller spaces. I was like, okay, I can bring this back to the U.S. In 2017, I made the decision as a New Year's resolution to start the Tiny Heights. We are different. Our homes are on foundation rather than wheels because we want to give our customers a starter home that they can invest in. These tiny houses aren't just getting into tiny houses because they can't afford traditional homes. It's because they live through the housing crisis. And that's the group that I've actually tailoring the community around. And currently we have 370 people on our wait list for the Houston community. One good thing about losing everything, I've understood clearly that all you have in life is purpose. I found that I want to spend the rest of my life being impactful to others. The greatest impact that I can provide right now is helping others avoid feeling the way that I felt when I was uprooted from my community and I lost everything.
We've got a picture of Jennifer Drew and more about her story on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. Check us out. And while we're there, we'd love it if you'd share your story about how the financial crisis changed you and those around you. The hashtag we're using is HowWeChanged. Coming up.
You know, we have a lot of discerning clients, and I'm trying to think of all the nice ways to describe it.
If by discerning you mean high maintenance, sure. Running a small business in a full employment economy. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, I'll tell you what, this is pretty bland music because it could have been the Wawa's. I will tell you what. The Dow Industrial is off 0.3%, 79 points, closed at 24,947. The Dow was off 794 points at the bottom. S&P 500 lost 0.1%, 4 points, ended things at 26.95. The NASDAQ actually up 0.4%, 29 points, 71.88 there. Stocks of major banks took some losses. Bank of America gave up 2%. Citibank down 3.5% today. Wells Fargo down 1.33%. Golden Globe nominations ushered in awards season officially, I suppose, today. Some tech and entertainment stocks rose. Netflix got 13 nominations, the most nods of any streaming service, gained 2.7%. Amazon, 9 nominations, rose 1.8%. But again, correlation is not causation. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace has a mission that drives what we do every day, to increase economic intelligence across the country. But we can't do it alone. So please, become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount you choose, and your donation will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. So please, donate today at Marketplace.org. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. MoviePass is a company perhaps some of you are familiar with, a movie subscription service that offered a daily ticket to the movies. Like, literally, you could go to a movie every day for only $10 a month. Cinephiles loved it, perhaps too much, though. The company started running out of money. It changed its subscription options without notice, lost a whole lot of goodwill. But now, reports Brooks Barnes in the New York Times today, they have got it figured out. Welcome to the program, Brooks.
Hi, thanks.
As I said in the introduction, MoviePass has had its trials and tribulations, but this time the company says they've got it fixed.
Yes, trust us. We listened, and it's a new and improved MoviePass.
Why do they believe that this time is going to be different?
Well, a couple things. You know, over the summer, it was just a circus, basically. Yeah. You know, changes every minute. It seemed like unannounced and unexplained outages. And then they did away with their unlimited plan, which kind of made all the noise go away. And since then, they've just been kind of quiet, looking at how can they reconfigure to not burn through as much cash and hopefully stick around a while.
Well, look, far be it for me to comment, but anybody could have seen that once you started offering the kind of prices they were offering, people were going to pile in and they were going to run out of money in a big, bad hurry, right?
The economics got scary really fast. They say that they expected people to come, but not nearly as many as did sign up. You know, it was like 3 million people in the course of a few months, which is pretty remarkable. At the same time, in my conversation with them, they talked about once they started seeing that growth, they just kind of went all in on it. And their explanation is that they lost focus on customer service and all of that, thinking, oh, well, people will stick with us with the price and we'll figure that out later, but it became a real wreck.
It has to be pointed out here that MoviePass is owned by a publicly traded company. It's called Helios and Matheson Analytics. The company has had some troubles with its debt load. I think its shares trade, honestly, at like 2 cents a piece now. Seems problematic.
The interesting, it didn't make it into my article, but the guy who has taken over MoviePass in 2017 and kind of started all of this, he talked to over 100 investors about his plan before Helios said yes. So that gives you a little idea of how many people looked at it and were like, yeah. I'm not, but Helios and Matheson is a little bit of a gonzo company. The guy who runs it is sort of a serial entrepreneur, but in areas that are a little eyebrow arching, vitamins, a psychic hotline. So that also adds to the challenges MoviePass faces in people trusting it.
One does have to wonder, though, in this age where content is everywhere and you don't actually have to go to a movie theater to see, really good content, what does the future hold? I mean,
one of the interesting things that gets a little overlooked about MoviePass in the industry is that theaters definitely didn't like them. Studios didn't like them for the same reason. But studios were a little warmer to the business plan. Fox, for example, paid it to promote certain movies. In those tests, they actually found out that many, many more people went to see some of these films than were otherwise going, because MoviePass cut out the risk. The box office overall for the year is way up. People think that MoviePass had a part in that. And, you know, theater owners don't like talking about that, but, you know, that brings people in. They buy popcorn for $20 or however much they're charging these days. Right. Yeah.
Brooks Barnes writes for the New York Times today about MoviePass and its latest incarnation. Brooks, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
As I said up top, the November unemployment report is going to be upon us tomorrow morning. I will leave the prognostication to others, but the jobless rate is still probably going to be pretty low, and the number of new jobs in this economy is probably still going to be not so bad as well, which, if you're running a small business, is not necessarily great news. There are more job openings in this economy than there are people looking for work, which is hitting small businesses especially hard. Kristen Schwab went talking to business owners in New York who are trying to get and retain talent.
Alon Flowers in Manhattan's Soho neighborhood is a sea of roses and ribbon. Christine Hall owns the shop with her husband, Patrick. She says a good bouquet takes precise work.
When I first learned how to do it, I was like making the tissue all wrinkly and it didn't look really pretty because you're like fighting with it and everything.
The business takes on everything from it's grandma's birthday to I need 50 bouquets for a magazine shoot and oh yeah, I need them tomorrow.
You know, we have a lot of discerning clients, and I'm trying to think of all the nice ways to describe it.
Like many small businesses, Hall needs employees who can do it all, including customer service. Hall would like to hire two more full-time florists, but she's had to rely on a network of freelancers instead, who often need training in the shop's style and whose schedules are inconsistent. That's forced her to wake up and smell the roses. To attract and retain employees, Alon Flowers added a 401k option for its staff of seven, who make $12 to $30 an hour. And she's considering offering health insurance.
We'd love to offer it to our employees, but it's very expensive. So, I mean, I think that that's probably a challenge across the board. I don't think that's unique to our business.
It's not, says Karen Kerrigan, CEO of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council. Service industry jobs are feeling the pressure to offer benefits that traditionally come with sitting behind a desk.
It's a very, very competitive environment for talent, for top talent, for all talent.
Now that the economy is good, people don't feel like they have to stay at jobs they don't love. That has companies fighting for their attention.
You have to be super, super active in recruiting the best talent and really being, I hate to use the word aggressive, but you have to go out there and really make an effort to bring in these people.
That's Jeff Cartwright, vice president of Morning Consult, a data research company about a half mile from Alon Flowers. It wants to double its staff of 84 in the next year, so the company hired recruiters to poach talent. He says it takes more than cool startup cliches to do it these days.
I think there's this trope with like young startup companies that having a ping pong table and a beer keg, right? Like that's enough to bring in employees.
The company is in a co-working space with, yes, beer on tap. But Cartwright says when talking to job candidates, he emphasizes not tech culture, but small business culture, like the ability to work across roles and lead projects. Still, the best way to find workers is, not surprisingly, to pay more. But that might be tough for businesses with thin profit margins, says Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic Policy and Research.
We probably will see a lot of low-paying businesses, a lot of restaurants, maybe some retail stores. They're going to go out of business because they can't get the workers they need. And that's the way a market economy works, for better or worse.
But the tight labor market doesn't seem to be too much of a damper right now. The National Federation of Independent Business found business owner optimism reached an all-time high this year. In New York, I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which we can report that Mick Mulvaney gets to go back to having just one job. Mulvaney, originally hired as the director of the Office of Management and Budget by the president, also took on running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau about a year or so ago. He renamed it the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, for one thing, also followed the Trump administration's deregulatory policies in the consumer finance field. Anyway, today the Senate confirmed Mulvaney's successor. Kathy Kreniger is her name. She was not uncontroversial as a nominee. She's got no experience in consumer finance, and she has never run a federal agency before. All right, we're done. Dow Industrials off 0.3% today, 79 points. S&P 500 down 0.1%, about 4 points. NASDAQ up, though, 0.4%, 29 points. Amir Bibawe, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.